Tonight, my guest at the big table has been involved in politics and political movements here in Chicago and around the country for over 50 years. Whether it was marching against the war in Vietnam or heading up the media for the 1983 campaign for Mayor Harold Washington, or even just recently helping to organize the Women's March on the day after the inauguration, Marilyn Katz has been at the epicenter of Chicago politics. Katz is an activist, writer, and owner of her own public relations firm called MK Communications, Public Strategies in the Public Interest. And Marilyn Katz is my guest tonight at the big table. Marilyn, good to see you.
Great to be here. It's been a while.
I mean, it's interesting because I was reading all the stuff on you, and you know, the stuff that popped up was a lot of media last year celebrating the 50-year mark for the march on Marquette Park with Reverend, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King. Talk about that. I mean, that what an amazing way to start your political career, to be, you know, hand in hand with Martin Luther King.
So I think for me, that year, that summer, was what Barack's campaign was to another generation and Trump's election to this group of millennials. So I was a kid in college. I was destined to be married, and I was a former Saks Avenue model. And then there was this thing happening in Chicago, and I was so compelled by what was happening in the South, kids getting beat up, that I decided that instead of being the little good sociologist I was supposed to be, I wanted to make history, not write about it. Started organizing in Uptown, met Dr. King, met Al Raby, watched us get beat up and firecrackers exploded on our feet, and it changed my life. But it not only changed my life, and this is what I tried to say when I wrote about it last year, the friendships forged when I was 18 with icons like Leon Finney and even Al Raby, those folks, as we grew up, came together in 1982, in the end of 82.
Yeah, it was the same people. Huh?
The same people. You know, I came back to Chicago from L.A. I was a big grown-up now, all of 30 years old or something. and those relationships forged, those bonds stayed together, and were at the center of the Harold Washington campaign that was victorious in 1983.
And I want to get to that campaign, because some of the things I read about, you know, and the things that you sort of went about the business of creating a media campaign for the mayor are pretty ingenious. But you know, when we talk about activism, about the idea of marching and being a part of a political movement, you had the opportunity to help out the organization that just did the Women's March here in Grant Park, Millennium Park, just this last, right after the inauguration. How has activism changed? How has it changed from those days from Marquette Park to what you experienced here on January 21st, 2017?
You know, it's really interesting. So many different ways. You know, as you say, I've been doing this for a really long time, but the 90s here were very kind of quiet. And then in 2001, we had 9/11, and then 2002, Bush was going to go to war. And I hadn't done anything for a decade. And I got a call and saying, we've got to do something about Bush going to war. And we called a little meeting, and we decided to have a demonstration. Well, nobody had gone on a demonstration like for a decade. So what do? I call it the first demonstration through the internet. And in a week and a half, we were able to mobilize 3,000 people, and Chicago became the first city to protest.
Was that hard for you to get back in the game after a decade where you're like, where's the signs? Where did everyone put the signs?
It was very funny. I mean, it was really, first of all, in some ways, it was much easier. Again, those folks from 68 were still kicking. They were still the core group. But the idea that you could really reach out to people through technology in a moment's notice was really revolutionary. And that was fun. What was interesting, and also, you know, I'll take it down to the March on Washington and the March in Chicago. The very fact that in 2 months, through social media, you could mobilize a 250,000 people or more was startling. One of the really different things is that what was fringy in 1965, 68 is really not today. So the reality is, except for that one moment at the Democratic Convention in 1968, most demonstrations in Chicago never had more than 1,000 people. Literally, never more than 1,000 people.
Interesting.
And even in August of 68, the only thing that took that from being a 500-person demonstration to a 5,000 or however many we had was the fact that the cops attacked us. If they'd never attacked,
it brought more people to the park.
It brought everybody. Everybody wanted to really get into it, which is another thing. I mean, certainly things in the city in some ways are more brutal. But the treatment of dissent in the 60s by Old Man Daley and by the cops was far more insidious, far more brutal.
And it's... There's, I mean, you think about the, what happened in Marquette Park and sort of the bottles and, the, like you said, the firecrackers being thrown at your feet. And you think about 1968 and the police and the clashes that happened in the park. It, Chicago has maybe not the strongest, as you just said. I mean, there's only been pockets of protests that have been over 1,000 people. But there's something about history that defines Chicago as a sort of epicenter for protest as
I
a
think
place.
It's true.
Why do you think that is? Because it's only been a couple of, like you just said, a handful of times that it's actually come to fruition.
You know, I think it's interesting, even though, one, because we are the Midwest, we are not the coast, and we are not New York intellectual dominated. And you know, both LA and New York are outliers. I mean, they're very, there's a, some truth in what the Trumpites say. I mean, they are really divorced from most of the country. And despite the fact that Chicago is known for its segregation, I would argue that it's the most integrated. It has a center. New York doesn't have a center. New York has seven boroughs and seven centers. And, you know, Midtown Manhattan is a land unto itself. L.A., you know, I lived in L.A. for a decade, and there was only one spot in the entire city where you could have a demonstration where black people and Latinos and whites would come together. One place, MacArthur Park. Nobody else would go into anyone else's territories. So Chicago has both been, because of its segregation, because of the tension, but also because of the fact that people could, it did have a center, is unique in that way. And also, there's another thing. You know, people talk about misery creating dissent and change. That's not true. I've always found that it's the possibility of something better, the possibility of real change that, that really propels people into action. And both in 68, because the headquarters of SDS was here, and we had a, the first women's movements, and we had Dr. King marching, you really got that sense of possibility. And so that made the 68 convention, you know, that was a very critical year. We had, it was the year of the greatest hope. You know, Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King had come out against the war, and then those hopes were shattered 6 months later.
Let's do this. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back. I have so many questions. I mean, obviously, we'll get into the – I want to get into the political campaigns that you've run and been a part of. All, you know, three of the last four mayors you have worked alongside. Marilyn Katz is my guest. She's an activist. She's a writer. Her public relations firm is called MK Communications. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back more with Marilyn. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio, Marilyn Katz, longtime activist, writer, public relations specialist, I'd say. She owns her own company, MK Communications. We're talking about her long career in activism and politics and political movements. And really, this, you know, let's talk about the transition you made from political movements and organizing protests to actually getting into politics, to running campaigns or being a part of campaigns. And it kind of, you kind of referenced it already at the beginning. It kind of started with Harold Washington.
It did start with Harold Washington. I had, really, it was partly actually started a poker game. I had come back to Chicago to start a women's organization nationally and to run another national left organization. And I had been a filmmaker in L.A. and was working as a director on McDonald's commercials and bored out of my skull. And nobody thought it was funny that they would pay someone $3,000 a day just to put sesame seeds on a bun. But I, you know, if somebody had thought it was funny, it would have been all right. I liked the money. But I was at a poker game, and this guy, Renault Robinson, was hanging around. And it turned out he was going to be the campaign manager for Harold Washington's third attempt at being mayor. And it's a game, which I still play in, by the way. Friendly game of poker, by the way. No illegal gambling. I said to him, you know, why don't you let me do his the media for his campaign? Come from L.A. and make, nobody else in the city really knows how to do film and politics, and I do both. So he's, oh, yeah, I'll have you talk to Harold Washington. So I brought in my friend Bill Zimmerman from California, and we made the pitch, and there I was. But interestingly enough, my first meeting with Harold Washington campaign was on New Year's Day, 1983. And I walk into this room at the house of Jackie Grimshaw, who was the head of field.
Yeah.
And there were all my old friends from 1968.
As you said, yeah.
You know, Leon
relationships,
Finney,
right.
Buzz Palmer, Bob Starks, Chuy Garcia. So all of us had grown up. So I had signed on to do the commercials, to do, media buy media, make commercials. And about 2 weeks later, we had no money at all. You know, nobody was giving to Harold Washington in the beginning of 83. They said, well, you have to do the press. Well, I'd never done press in my life. But I figured if I took the skills that I had making film and took my politics. So we did a storyboard for every day. And I would create a 1.5 minute commercial using free press. And it became a real thing. And that was fun.
What was the original? I mean, I'm curious just in my own, mind about what was the response of the press to Harold Washington in 1983. I mean, when we go back in that story in history, it's like, oh, what a groundswell. Everyone was talking Harold. But was the press on board? Were they taking Harold Washington seriously in 1983?
It was interesting. I mean, it became, in the beginning, no. They thought, oh, it was just the third time and a third and out. But by mid-January, there was something happening. There was a different feeling in the air. Jane Byrne was not up, and it became a big, you could see the discontent in the streets, and suddenly it became more exciting. I mean, he had some cachet, and the things that we were doing with the press ginned up more interest.
Mm-hmm.
And we did go on radio by the end of January, and suddenly it seemed like there was viability. And because, in fact, this time he also had some white supporters, it really empowered and emboldened the black community who began to believe. So it began to parlay itself. And by February, we were the ticket.
Here's what
actually,
I remember.
Actually, here's what the ticket. And the night that Jane Byrne, Harold was a brilliant orator. He could play with language and drive you nuts. And he did drive Jane Byrne nuts. And the minute on January, whatever the late January debate was, when she tore the telephone out of the wall and threw it at her media advisor, was I knew that we were actually making some headway.
I think about that time, and I think about the marketing materials, and I think about the campaigns. I mean, I think about the media that was done by some of the other candidates, the people that were against Harold Washington. I mean, Ira Glass did the great This American Life episode about how it's just overtly racist.
It was overtly racist.
I mean, just for 1980, this wasn't the 50s. This was 1983 in Chicago. At the time, I mean, how do you respond to that as a media?
Well, it was very interesting. It was very interesting. I mean, so, and I'll be very frank with you. When we won the primary, we actually naively expected that most Democrats would line up with us. And then they didn't. And it wasn't just at Bredoliak's. There were social liberals on the North Shore who just could not bring themselves to line up. But in fact, and we were in the general when, as you will remember, Bernie Upton before It's Too Late, where a lot of the Democrats really were aligning themselves.
I mean, his tagline was before it's too
before
late.
Before it's too late. And actually there was a wonderful reporter named Michael Zelenziger who was working at the Sun-Times, and a woman named Diane Apt who was here happened to be reporters and really captured Ed Bredoliak saying, any white person who votes for anybody south of Madison is a traitor to the race. So, and we were down. We were down. The weekend before the general election, we were down about 17 points. And Bill Zimmerman, my companion and a wonderful filmmaker, made two commercials that only showed once. And we showed them against the orders of the Finance Committee of the campaign. They were called Shame. One was called Shame, and one was called The Pledge.
Yeah.
And at that time, you could block the entire TV. You could buy all four channels, and we did that once on Sunday night and blocked the entire...
And that turned it around.
Well,
that's your thought, right? 17 points in a week.
A robust turnout by the black community, great organizing, and that moment of self-doubt that made people not probably vote for Harold Washington, but made some people stay home.
Marilyn Katz is a longtime activist, political, I would say you ran political campaigns and done media for Harold Washington. That's what we were just talking about, the 1983 campaign. She's also a writer. You can see here, you can read her stuff. And in these times, Huffington Post, other places, and also her own PR company, MK Communications. All right, we'll take a break. We'll get tonight's news from Rob. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation. Marilyn Katz at the big table. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight at the big table, Marilyn Katz, longtime activist, writer, owner of her own company, MK Communications, does public relations. We were just talking before the break about her time with the Harold Washington campaign, running media, giving us a great history lesson of one of the most surprising, if not biggest, political campaigns in American history. The first African-American mayor in Chicago, right?
And laid the groundwork for two things. And when Harold became mayor, things fundamentally changed in the city in terms of democracy and never went back. So when I came back and when Harold was running, pretty much every decision in the city was made by the Civic Committee of the Commercial Club. And there was going to be a World's Fair, and a very small group of older white men made all decisions in town.
Hmm.
And Harold blew that apart. We now have a Democratic committee that views all developments in the city, you know, decision-making. Not only did the city council change, people became involved. First of all, Harold couldn't win anything in Springfield because he had no friends. So then we evolved the public issue campaign. My first campaign, I had no idea what I was doing, was in that spring, the next spring, where we fought to ban leaded gasoline. But there was no way to do it in the old boy way. They couldn't go in the back rooms. So we had to organize around the issue.
Ah, that's fascinating.
And we changed
yeah.
the politics. And then the city council changed, you know. And we ended up with a congressional delegation. Look at this. Jan Schakowsky, who brought freshness dates to cottage cheese. Danny Davis, who was a health activist in the 60s. And radical Bobby Rush, who was a Black Panther. Luis Gutierrez, who was part of the Puerto Rican Socialist Party. We had the most radical.
It's fascinating to think about the delegation, the congressional delegation, all comes from the roots of the Harold Washington administration.
That's exactly right.
After Harold Washington, and this, I mean, the candidate that you guys beat in Mayor Richard M. Daley became mayor of Chicago and lasted longer than his father. You had a relationship with the Daley family in the way that you were somewhat despised by the father and you worked alongside the son. So talk about that. I mean, because what a contrasting personalities when you think of Harold Washington and Richard M. Daley.
It's really fascinating. And I have to say one thing that I respected greatly about Daley and his embrace of me and of Bill Ayers was that as long as you were willing to work for the city, as long as you were really willing to work on the issues that he was very passionate about and you were passionate about, that was the basis.
He was respectful.
Of the relationship. He was respectful. In fact, he spoke at when BPI, Business and Public and Professionals in the Public Interest, honored Bill Ayers, Daley was there and spoke. I mean, so he's a peculiar man. So they are very different.
Yeah.
And what I always say, I mean, first of all, you know, it was always ironic that Daley and I became close when I was fighting, you know, my firm does more than PR. We do issue-based strategies, et cetera. And I was trying to pass the first law that was called the low-income housing tax credit, which is now the way we produce housing in the country. And I had to convince this guy, Richard Daley, who I had defeated a few years ago. And he immediately saw the value of what it was doing, embraced it. And for 6 years, until it became a permanent thing, never let it go. He forced Rostenkowski to take it up, and I had the Senate already locked up. And so he really respected issues. And what was really tremendously ironic is that Harold, who was an intellectual, who could write a speech and could out-speechify me, would really love politics. He loved politics. And Daley, who is known as the Paul, really was a policy nerd. In fact, it was shocking that he had read probably more books. He had read Jane Jacobs. He had read Cisneros. He read everything that I had read on public policy. And he would, you know, and it was always surprising.
You know, it's surprising, I think, for a lot of people to hear that because of his public persona. I think there was a persona that he was a little, he would get up there and he would motor through his speeches, or he may be short with the press, and he sort of took on this sort of everyman approach, but he didn't seem to be well studied.
So it depended on the issue. And I was talking about this with my family the other day. If he knew an issue well, he was brilliant. In fact, I've seen him mesmerize all these college intellectuals that I work with around the country. And if he hadn't fully formulated an issue, he would sound like a Southwest Side guy who had no idea what he... And sometimes, you know, that old saying, you know, listen to what he means, not what he says, comes true. But he has given, the same time, the year before he quit, he gave the most elegant speech on... eloquent speech on community development and the future of cities that I've ever heard anyone give. And I hear lots of people all the time. It was interesting. I mean, I think probably my relationship with Daley and his very selfless and very wise work on the low-income housing tax credit probably was the reason that I did less political candidates and started doing more issue-based mm-hmm. work. That it was very clear, both from that experience working nationally, that at some point, unless there was a real reason, I mean, there are reasons to really jump into a fight like I did for Barack, but not for money, but that issues were where it was at.
Now, a lot would say, and a lot of people that have aligned them, that you've aligned yourself with, the same relationships that we talked about that were in the back room of the Harold Washington campaign, the progressive Democrats of Chicago, don't necessarily see that when they talk about Mayor Daley and his legacy. They see him as someone who stifled the progressive movements of Democrats. How do you sort of see it as someone who was part of that team, that legacy, but also had a good relationship and worked well with Mayor Daley?
You know, I think that I think there were obviously people who got smashed by Daley. I mean, I think that Chuy Garcia lost his seat when Victor Reyes and organized against him. And that was true, that he chose his friends and he chose his enemies. On the other hand, I think that people like Helen Schiller or Tony Preckwinkle, who never bent, neither of them bent a bit, you know, stood up, they organized their base, and when they were going to go to battle with Daley, or they didn't always have to battle. You know, they would, you know, Helen would say, "You're wrong," and then talk to him. But when she needed to, she would go to war and she would win.
Marilyn, you know, I listen to these stories, and it's great. I could talk to you all. I mean, it's so great. I love the history of the city and its politics. When you say organize their people, and you talk about Helen Schiller, the 46th Ward alderman, or Tony Preckwinkle when she was an alderman, and she would amass a machine, if you will. Is that still the way politics works? I mean, do you have to do that? I mean, 2017.
Let's look at the last. I mean, what's amazing about the last mayor's race is that it cost Rahm $33 million to win that race. And what was interesting to me and what everybody should look at was they couldn't defeat Rahm. They didn't, you know, but the Progressive Caucus and those people who were, turned themselves at, won 17 seats in city council, 15 to 17, depends mm-hmm. how you count, in city council. So what it told me is that you probably couldn't win a statewide election yet, but that folks who really dug deep and did their base building and did organizing could win local elections.
Does it seem familiar to you? I mean, when you think of Harold Washington, how he ran sort of as a uniter of progressive Democrats, does 2017 feel familiar?
In some ways, this feels more organized. So that there was a mass movement, it was Harold and the people, but really the folks that got into office were his choices for office. And this is much more grassroots. And it may be, you know, it's a really funny thing. In a lot of bad ways, you know, we're much more siloed than we were before, but there is a depth in organization that has replaced the old machine. The machine does not exist.
It doesn't.
It does not exist. You know, and it doesn't exist in Chicago, and it doesn't exist across the state. There are little mini machines, but they're pretty... I would say probably progressive aldermen had the best of them.
Now, let me ask you this. I mean, and I'll ask you this, then we'll take a quick break, and then we'll wrap up. But do you see, does it mean that the vehicles, that have been used by Chicago politicians for years to amass teams and machines and sort of follow a blueprint that really was created and dominated by Mayor Daley, the original Mayor Daley. I mean, is that still a blueprint, a pathway for a politics in a city like Chicago?
You know, I think that the old patronage pathway has been gone dead. Just people forgot that it really was dead. But once you lost the ability to do patronage, you know, Shachtman in the 80s really did make a huge change. If you no longer had the ability to give away jobs, your army was going to be diminished. And it's actually, frankly, for a politician, it's hard to know how to move. And let's take some examples. It took Rahm a huge media campaign to win the election.
Right.
And the reassembly of an army, because he doesn't have a patronage army, and it took a lot of the work by the aldermen and some folks who really had deep relationships in communities, whether it be in the north side or south side. Pat Quinn lost, not because the Republicans got more votes, but because the Democrats didn't come out to vote. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting thing because, you know, you now have, let's look at the governor's race. You've got J.B. Pritzker talking about running, multi-billionaire, but he has no roots in the black community. And without the black community, you cannot win the governorship in Illinois. You have Chris Kennedy, has a better name in the black community for those over 50, but those under 50 probably have no real idea, or the vaguest idea.
Right.
I guess there's a new movie on Jackie Kennedy. And then you've got Amaya Pirawara and Daniel Biss. I mean, what is your strategy? I mean, you have to put together.
Of those candidates is going to have to go court the African-American
community. If any of them have any chance of winning, because it was really, like in my ward, there was no more Republican votes for Rahner than there was for the previous Republican, but the Democrats stayed home. They just weren't excited.
Marilyn Katz, my guest tonight at the big table. Let's take a quick break so we can come back and have a couple minutes to talk about how politics have changed. And also, we haven't had a chance to talk about Mayor Emanuel and what's next. Marilyn Katz, my guest tonight at the big table. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Marilyn Katz is my guest in studio. She's at the big table tonight. Longtime activist, writer, public relations specialist, MK Communications. Talking politics and her career. We only got a couple minutes left. I'm fascinated. I mean, 630 just sent in a great point to say we were talking about machine politics. With Madigan still in Springfield, talking about Speaker Madigan, how can you say that the machine isn't as well-oiled as ever?
Well, ask Pat Quinn. I mean, you could argue that that Madigan didn't want him to win, but that is not why Pat Quinn lost. I mean, Madigan nor anybody else could pull out the vote for Quinn. Madigan has tight control in the State House. There's no question about it. And how that control is exercised is not because he controls a lot of mass votes. He controls committee chairs, and he controls what bills ever get out of committee.
Right, and that's different than a machine.
That is very different than a machine.
Yeah. He may be great in his ward. You're not going to beat him in his ward, right?
He controls his ward, but that's about it.
And it's interesting because that gets played out and almost becomes like Chicago machine becomes what Governor Rahner is running against. This idea of it's a national bad word, right?
Right. Rahner is like obsession with Mike Madigan. And actually in this building, the Tribune's obsession, which if they were really going to be obsessed, they should have done it about 6 years ago. I mean, there are a lot of politicians in the state that who do things that are questionable, guess what? Defeat them. There is a way. I'm not a big fan of term limits. If you don't like someone's behavior, boot them out. That is the essence. That's the fun of democracy.
Right. Rahm Emanuel, Mayor Emanuel, you've had the chance to work alongside. You got some nice print in the Tribune not too long ago about when they released the emails. You were in there.
I was in there.
Talking about, you know, and there was questions about whether or not you were lobbying outside of lobbying by asking for a meeting. What's your relationship with Mayor Emanuel, and where does he stack up when you talk about working with Harold Washington and Richard M. Daley? I mean, talk about his personality.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, met him during the Harold Washington years. And in fact, this is really a little known fact. I met him because he had been trained as a community organizer by the city's best community organizer, Jan Schakowsky, and her husband.
Why
Mark
is that
Creamer.
Story not told? I don't think of Mayor Emanuel
no
at all
idea.
Like a community organizer.
No, yeah. I mean, that's really what he came out of. That whole training school, the Midwest Academy, where he was, you know, schooled as being a community organizer. Always, always always a hyper, always a, I'm trying to find a non-swear word for this. Always a bit of a son of a bitch, if you can say that on radio, I'm not sure. But, you know, prickly, but very, very bright. And so, you know, that was where our relationship started. And then I got to know him when he was in Clinton White House, for better and worse. But, you know, Rahm, too, has always been best at a backroom player. He, retail politics has not been the easiest thing. I mean, he went in the White House with Clinton when he was both in the White House, responsible for the relations of with Congress. It was not retail politics.
Right.
It was wholesale. It was making the deal with the guy. Rahm gets here, you know, and had some opposition from the beginning, but very competent, but had not been tremendously progressive, seen as a progressive on issues of the war in Iraq. He was not, you know, well, Obama came out very quickly at the rally we did in 2002. Rahm was not there, had to be pushed to take an anti-war stand. So he was never going to be the darling of the left. I mean, the darling of the left in 2010 when he ran was Miguel de Valle or Carol Moseley Braun.
Right.
And then Gary Chico in the middle, and then Rahm as Obama's favorite, but not necessarily the city's. You know, and Rahm is really different than both Harold and Daley. And one of the things is, Daley is a guy of the neighborhoods. I mean, I would be in a car with Daley or flying back from somewhere, and he would make the car pull over and write down where the pothole was. I mean, he knew every damn street in the city. Harold was not that obsessive, but he really had the soul. He loved the adulation. He was a people man. He was a flirt. He flirted with men and women, with children, with old people. He danced the polka. Rahm is not that. Rahm is a much more stiff kind of guy, less at ease in crowds, less at ease with people. Has an attention span. If you give him a page and a half on an issue, he'll say, "Well, how about a page?" And if you give him the page, he'd really like it. 3 points in a paragraph. But I think, you know, I think politically in another city he'd be considered a social liberal. But I think that, you know, as I've said to him, I think not knowing the city and really spending all those years in Washington has made him a bit of a stranger, and that hurts him more than anybody.
We're running out of time here, and
and we're having
we're going to make a new segment. This is the Big Table Maryland Cats Part One. How's that? So then
sounds
you have
good.
To come back sometime in the next couple of weeks, and we'll do Part Two, because there's so many questions I have. I mean, we haven't even gotten into how politics have changed and all that. Maryland Cats, my guest tonight at the Big Table, longtime activist, writer, also the owner of MK Communications here in town. Maryland, thanks for being here, and I look forward to having you
back.
Thank
you. I'll be looking forward to being back.